Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi and welcome. How you doing? Thank you so much for the messages I got after last week's podcast. It was great that Karen, thank you Karen, our Sober Club member, inspired so many people. It's just lovely, isn't it? Just hearing stories of how people are just living their best life. It honestly just never ceases to amaze me just the magic people create once they get free from the alcohol trap and they come back to who they really are and kind of find themselves again. That's it really, isn't it? I think we sometimes realise that we've lost ourselves somewhere along the way. So yeah, thank you to Karen and Oddbird. Lots of people have been trying Oddbird. If you want any information on great alcohol-free drinks, just message. And obviously, if you're a member of the Sober Club, we talk about great alcohol-free drinks a lot. We've got some great competitions to try and win some. And, you know, as we get into this time of year when more and more people are socialising outdoors, you know, it's a thing. It really is a thing that the sunshine and the warm weather starts to trigger people. And, you know, there's that little wine witch on the shoulder saying, well, you know, it's summer and you can just have one and all of that nonsense. So, you know, this is the time, if you haven't before, to just embrace alcohol-free drinks. You know, let's just be clear, they're drinks without alcohol. They are not addictive. And I had a couple of clients this week. I've just started my 12-week accountability kind of package, and some fabulous committed people really, really determined to do this, which is brilliant. But a couple, you know, said to me that same thing of, oh, well, you know, if I decide not to drink alcohol, if I'm going to commit to this, I'm just going to drink orange juice, you know, with a bit of sparkling water with it, or I'm just going to stick to my Coke, or worse still, Diet Coke or whatever. And this, you have to challenge this with yourself. I mean, of course, if that does it for you, great. But for most of us, it doesn't. That's the truth of it. It doesn't. We end up feeling that we're deprived. And it's very hard to do this. If you've been drinking for many, many, many years, if you're a grey area drinker, you know that term by now. We're not talking about people who are clinically dependent. We're talking about those people who are drinking more than they want to, who have had periods of being without the booze, and, you know, can stop. They don't need alcohol to get them kickstarted of a day, but they're drinking way more than they want to. You know, for those people, for the grey area drinkers, then it absolutely is possible to make this decision and to stop. I'm not saying it's simple. You know, there are things that make it a little easier for you. You've got to push through the hard bits. But without doubt, what makes it easier is if some of your habits, in inverted commas, and your routines and your rituals can remain in place. You've got so much change going on that if some of your rituals can stay in place, it will make it easier. So if you're the sort of person that always has a drink, you know, with your partner, particularly in the sunshine, in early evening, or whatever it might be, whatever your rituals are, there is going to be a part of you that wants to hang on to them. And nothing wrong with that, right? We're adults. We seek pleasure and we want it quick, right? But it doesn't have to be in the form of toxic liquid. Have a lovely glass of something alcohol-free. And the choice is massive, as I'm sure you know. If you're listening to the podcast for the first time, wow, you have so much joy and excitement ahead of you, discovering everything from kombuchas to artisan tonics to syrups to alcohol-free ciders and botanicals and beers and wines and fizz and everything, literally everything. There is a really wonderful alcohol-free version of, which won't do you any harm, which there's no way it should trigger you. Of course, if you think it's going to, choose something else. The choice is massive. But that really isn't, you know, enough of a reason. Somebody said to me, I go and see my elderly dad, and it's like the one thing that we can appreciate together is that he likes to have a little whiskey and I have a little glass with him. And I don't know what I'm going to do if I can't do that. It's what holds us together. And, you know, there's some truth in that statement. Alcohol is that, literally, that social glue, isn't it? It's frightening how we've made it so important in our culture. But of course, the answer is he He can still have his whiskey if he wants to. You pour yourself a lovely liar's alcohol-free version of whiskey and, you know, he doesn't even need to know. What's the difference? It's just what you're consuming, and it absolutely doesn't have to be something harmful, right? So, anyways, that's my little rant for this week. Obviously, if you're not already a member, check out the Sober Club, because there's just so much inspiration in there, so much great content, whatever stage you're at. You know, you heard Karen last week. She's been sober over 2 years, and there's still masses for her within the Sober Club. So, and we have some very exciting stuff coming up, by the way. We had a really good Q&A with Jane Thurnell-Reed, who was talking about weight management. We've got something really exciting coming up, which I'm not even sure I dare reveal, because I'll have to wait and see. But anyway, a really fabulous special guest who's going to be chatting to us and doing an exclusive Q&A for us in the Sober Club. So check it out if you haven't already, thesoberclub.com. Now, this week's guest is a little bit more serious. I thought, you know, every now and then it's time to really focus on just how terrible alcohol is, if the truth be told. I mean, you know that my approach is positive sobriety, and I absolutely want to focus on what's to come. But I do think we have to make it super clear just how damaging this drug is. Some of you may have heard of Sarah Drade. She's been doing a lot of work around the fact that she was a child of an alcoholic parent and the massive impact that had on her, not just through childhood and teens, but even into adult life, and how it affects absolutely everything. So, you know, there are some bits of this interview that are, you know, quite upsetting. I'll just give you a heads up on that. But I think it's really important to share this. And if it's something you're going through, you know, we do give you some suggestions of where you can reach out. And I think it's just another really amazing reminder for us all that we're not, you know, I know that I laugh a lot, I joke a lot. I'm really up for the positive approach. But I'm also really super aware of just how damaging this drug is. So I really hope you enjoy. I'm not sure enjoy is quite the right word, because, you know, it's kind of sad, but it's also uplifting, because Sarah's doing amazing work. So enjoy the interview. My guest is Sarah Drade, who gave a fantastic TED Talk, Alcoholism, The Deadly Truth About Its Stigma, and is doing some amazing work, which we'll get into talking about, no doubt. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, Janie. Thank you so much for having me.
It's no worries. I've been, you know, trying to get you on the podcast for ages, and finally, finally get to connect. So obviously we'll get into the campaigns and the work that you're doing now. But just take me back in time then, and tell me what happened for you, because, you know, I know this is not going to be one of the cheeriest topics we've covered, you know, to say the least, but I think it's hugely important to cover it, really. And it's not my experience. It's not something I can, you know, really help people with. So I think it's great that you're doing this work. So tell us what happened for you growing up then.
Thank you, Janie. I mean, and yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not cheery at all. So it's really important that I just say that before I go into detail and perhaps put a little trigger warning in front of this. Talking about the way my dad died and his death from alcohol use disorder and what that meant for us as a family and how that impacted us. I was incredibly close with my dad. He was, as far as I was concerned, he was the man that I'd go to for advice. I could tell him anything. He would listen non-judgmentally. He was very wise beyond his years. He would say things to me like, if I was being dramatic, and he often called me dramatic, bless him. He'd say things like, woman up, or he was a feminist, and he was absolutely amazing. He was loving, he was sensitive, he was kind. And I say all of this because there is such a huge stigma attached to alcohol use disorder or alcoholism, however anybody recognizes it. But he was always a heavy drinker. He developed PTSD, anxiety and depression, following a traumatic event. And that's when I really noticed a change in my dad. significant change. He became more withdrawn, his attitude began to change, his personality began to change. He wasn't as forthcoming or as happy or as talkative as he used to be. And that was when I was a teenager, I really started noticing that difference in him. And it was, as I was a teenager, I developed this resentment and this bitterness towards him, but I didn't understand that he changed because he was drinking too much. So when I say he changed, he was just bitter and angry about everything. He always had a glaze on his face, like a glaze in his eyes, or his face was puffy or red. And he always had this distinctive smell, which I now know is alcohol.
Were you aware that he was drinking? I mean, did you see him drink, or did he keep that secret?
I knew my dad drank, but I didn't think it was a problem. I was so, the thing is, Janie, I was so used to seeing him.
Exactly. That's the case, isn't it? It's just the norm, isn't it, for so many children? It's just absolutely what their parents do.
Do you know, the real funny thing is, and I realised this at Christmas, when all the kids would put a mince pie out and a glass of milk out for Santa, my dad was telling us to put a glass of whiskey out and a mince pie. And it weren't until I met my husband that I realised that my husband went, whiskey? Why were you putting whiskey out? And I thought, isn't that what everyone does? Everyone drinks. Isn't that just normal? And I know that's so silly as an example, but that was how normal it was. It was so, so normal that I didn't realise that it was a problem or that it wasn't right. And we were so in denial, even when...
Was your mum around too? Was she drinking?
Mum was around. Mum drank, but not to the extent my dad did.
Right.
She enjoyed a drink, but it weren't consuming of my mum. She could take it or leave it. Whereas I really noticed late teens, my dad wouldn't drive. So if we were going out anywhere, my mum would be the one driving all the time. If somebody had to pick us up from school, it wouldn't be my dad. My dad couldn't. It would be my mum. And I never used to understand, well, dad's at home, why can't he just pick me up? I don't understand why you're making me catch a bus, or why you're doing this, or why you're doing that. It was always the drink.
Was he holding down work at this point?
No.
Right, okay.
No, my mum, and this is another thing with the stigma that's attached to it. There were so many stigmas that I was contending with. My dad, through no fault of his own, went through something incredibly traumatic and lost everything. And as a result, we ended up, so I come from this affluent background, and then suddenly we were struck into poverty. So my dad was so angry over what happened to him, and so consumed with resentment and bitterness. And it's not something that I can really talk about, but it had a massive impact on my dad.
Well, he turned to the only way out, didn't he?
It was his
that he felt was the only way out. Yeah.
And he used to say to me, I drink to forget.
Yeah.
I didn't understand then what he meant by that. As an adult now I get it. I understand, okay, you was consumed with anxiety and depression, and drinking was your only way to mask that, to numb the pain. It was overwhelming. My mum, no, she wasn't a drinker. My mum was the glue. Mum kept everything together. Mum made sure that we had some kind of normality, whatever normality is, but some kind of normality. And my dad spent a lot of time passed out on the sofa by 5 o'clock. His attitude, you could always tell. I could always tell when he'd been drinking. Through the tone of his voice, and people would think I was mad. Like, my husband would say to me when I first met him, there were so many occasions where he'd say, why are you giving him a hard time?
Yeah, he seems fine to me.
He didn't know. I did.
I know exactly what you mean. My mum had mental illness, and I only needed to hear her say two words, and I knew that she was on some kind of bipolar thing going on. It's really interesting, isn't it?
It's a tone of voice. That's and sad, it's the environment that you become attuned to.
Yeah. So at this point, then, I know that your work now is all around, the stigmas that are attached to all of this. And clearly,
You know, as you say, you come from a relatively affluent background. So, you know, your dad isn't the kind of person that would, you know, be, we expect to be in a skip or in vodka on the cornflakes and all the ridiculous stereotypes that we have. So was he asking for help at all, or was he ashamed, so ashamed at that point that he didn't feel worthy of any help?
No, he didn't ask for help.
So he literally didn't no. go to a GP, didn't do anything.
There was one time he did towards the end, but we forced him into that. Right. That's really important that I say forced him into it. I didn't understand that he had an illness or a disorder at this point. I was so angry with him. And this was towards the end. So I was, at this point, I was married with two children.
Right.
And I forced my dad into admitting that he had a problem. He turned up to a family holiday and he was absolutely wasted. And I had the children with us. And I said to him, Dad, you cannot come on holiday with us like this because it will take you the week to sleep it off. I'm going to drop you home and we'll talk about this when we get back. I mean, I felt like I had to protect my family. I couldn't have them around that. And it creates such a low atmosphere and environment. And it dampens my mood, and I had to protect myself, and I had to detach from that daughter mode of worrying about him and only allocate myself certain times to worry. So when we got back from that holiday, I gave him an ultimatum, and I said, if you do not stop drinking or admit that you have a problem, then you will not see your grandchildren again, and you won't see your daughters again. Now, I did that because I knew that we were my dad's weakness. I knew that. And when I said at the beginning how loving, how sensitive, my dad projected a lot of love. He was a very sensitive, caring man. And he doted on his girls. And I'm one of three girls, and I was his eldest. And he doted on us. So I knew that by removing us from the situation and by demonstrating to him that this is what will happen if you don't get help.
Yeah.
I was almost taking away that codependency.
Yeah, exactly. That's the tough love, isn't it, that you had to show.
But what I didn't realise is that when he did the detox, because he come around 3 months, took 3 months, and I'd check in. I wouldn't see him, but I'd pick up the phone and I'd check to see that he hadn't died.
So did he do it on his own then? Ask for help?
He eventually, 3 months later, he rung and he said, I will do anything you tell me to do. Whatever you want me to do, ring whoever you need, I will do it. So I did it. I booked his appointment. He met me there. He did the detox, and he was physically dependent on alcohol.
So when you say did the detox, you mean he worked with a kind of the equivalent of local alcohol services and a daily rehab kind of scenario, not somewhere residential?
No, it wasn't residential. They came to him. So he had like a nurse that would come into his house every day and administer the medication.
Okay.
He didn't follow up with any of the recommended psychological support.
Ah, right. So he only effectively dealt with the physical.
He did the detox, yes. So he could safely come off of the alcohol, because when he tried to come off of it, he was vomiting, he was shaking.
Yeah, it's really dangerous, isn't it, to do it quickly.
Yeah, like, even then it still didn't compute. I still didn't register. You still think that you're in denial. They say the alcoholic's in denial, but so are the loved ones.
Yeah,
like you are in denial. And I was so used to this that I just assumed, okay, we've been in this situation so many times, and bearing in mind this was the first detox, I just assumed that he's not drinking anymore, he's no longer an alcoholic. And I would get so defensive. And somebody once said to me, oh, Sarah, your dad will always be an alcoholic. And I was so upset by that comment. And I was so defensive of him. And I thought, how dare you? How dare you say that? He's off. Like, he doesn't drink anymore. He's no longer an alcoholic. But I was so naive to it. I didn't understand it. None of us did, really. And it took one traumatic event. So the 2017, he lost his, so he'd been sober for 12 months at this point, and we lost my granddad, my dad's dad. And he didn't let on how much it had affected him. And he slowly, after that, he began to change again, but he got better at hiding it this time around. But also this time around, he weren't going to the weaker strengths of alcohol like he used to have. So he might have had lager or cider, or it was the cheap it was the cheap cider that he would get absolutely wasted on. And this time he was going to vodka neat.
Right.
And he was doing a litre a day. And I clocked on that he had relapsed by one phone call, funny enough. One phone call, and I recognised the tone. Mm. I said, "You've been drinking." And he was adamant, "I haven't." And I just went in. Honestly, the rage, the frustration, the anger. And I said some horrendous things to him, like really horrendous things. It took a lot of therapy for me to get out, but I said it out of frustration. So I swore at him and I told him I hated him. And I told him that, you know, right now you'd be better off dead, and awful things, Janie. Like, I was so angry. Angry because I could see what it was doing to him, but this time felt different. This time felt like I was bashing my head against a brick wall and nobody was helping. I was trying to ring support services to
I was going to ask, did you ever consider going to I've forgotten what it's called, the relatives of alcoholics? There's one, there is a group, isn't there?
So you've got AdFam or Yeah, I know. I did go to a session after he died, actually. But prior to that, no, I rang his GP. I liaised with his GP, and because that was the only, at that point, it was just sheer desperation. And my mum and dad had separated by this point. My mum could no longer handle the drinking. And once all of her girls had grown up and moved out, so did she. And as my dad's eldest, I took on that responsibility of looking after him. Mm. And caring for him, and which came with its own baggage, and I developed my own anxiety because of the lack of control that I had over him. It was projected onto something else, but I rung his GP and I expressed my concern, and I rung charities, I rung so many places. I deliberated trying to pull all the money together myself to put him through a private rehab facility. And he wasn't budging. He was so adamant that he could get off of it himself again, and that he will be fine. And he's come off of it before, he'll come off of it again. And I got a phone call off of him one day, and it was really unusual because he never used to tell me about anything that he was worried about in terms of his health. It was never something that he discussed with me, but he rung me and he explained that he'd been coughing up some blood and he was worried and he was crying. And I sensed that that was not like my dad. So I rushed up there to him, and he's on his bed. He's curled up, he's shivering, he's shaking, he's bloated. His belly was so, so bloated. And I looked at him and I said, "Right, we need to call an ambulance. You need to go to hospital. I think you have, you've got a problem. You must have liver failure or something." And it was almost in that moment, bearing in mind, I said that I felt like the grown up, that I was the one looking after him. He took control back in that moment, and he really put me in my place. And looking back, he was gaslighting me, not in a nasty way or a, like, intentional way, but he was telling me that I was being dramatic and that I was worrying over nothing, and I was making a big deal about something. And then he turned around and also said to me that when I said, "You really do need to go to a hospital," he said, "I will not be getting into an ambulance and I will not be going to hospital. I have done this to myself. I will get off of this myself. There are people at that hospital that need doctors more than I need them. I don't deserve it." And it was then that it clicked, and I thought, "You're frightened about being discriminated against. You're frightened about the shame that this illness comes with." But I walked away that day. I was so angry. I walked out and I said, "I can't watch you do this to yourself." That took a lot of for me to get over, because even now I wonder what would have happened if I would have just called 999. But I didn't. I walked away. And I hate saying all of this. I really do. But I feel it's so important that I'm as brutally honest as possible, because this is the reality of this illness. It's also worth mentioning that, yeah, he did always used to make me feel like I was being dramatic, that I was worrying over nothing. And then I used to question, has he got a problem or am I making this up? So I doubt, even now I doubt things. I doubt myself. So I'm always seeking reassurance from somebody. Mm. Like, I'm not going mad, am I? Am I? Do you agree with me? Do you think that I am? Like, it's always that constant approval seeking that I've carried over into other areas of my life. Mm. 3 days later, we got a phone call. It was my sister. And she just said to me, you need to get to the hospital. Dad's in a bad way. And when I got there, he was sat up and he looked different. He was in a wheelchair. He was vacant. He didn't recognize me. He was clammy and he was white with a yellow tinge to him. He didn't look drunk. Now, people might think, well, what do you mean he didn't look drunk? There was a way. There was a look that my dad had when he was drunk. This look was different. This look was, I can't explain it, but I knew it was different. And I think it's something called wet brain. I think his blood weren't filtering properly. His liver weren't filtering his blood. So the toxins had gone to his head. And he looked at me and he just asked for his car keys. And he wanted to check that his girls were okay. And I said, Dad, it's me, I'm here. Like, we're going to get you better, you're okay. And from then he moved from ward to ward, but in severity. So we moved from A&E, like assessments, to majors. And we were in majors and we moved to, had some tests in there, and then they moved him to resus. Mm-hmm. And in resus, it still wasn't computing. I was still in denial. We were all in denial. And there's two surgeons that are stood at the end of his bed reading these results, and they're explaining to me what's going on. And there's people there fitting tubes on him, getting him ready for a blood transfusion because he was internally bleeding. He had bruises that just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And two surgeons looked at me and said that they'd noticed that my dad's chest was rattling. So they did a chest x-ray and they found that 3/4 of his lungs on both sides were filled with fluid. So they were getting ready to remove the fluids, so drain all the fluids that had accumulated. Still didn't compute it, still didn't register. And he was really, he was in and out at this point. So at one point he'd recognize us and then he'd come back round and then he'd wouldn't, and then he would, and then he wouldn't. And last thing he said to me was actually, I love you. That was the last thing he said to me. And I went that day, and then the next day he was moved into intensive care, and they put him on dialysis. And that's where it really all went downhill from there. He wasn't responding to anything. He was having the maximum doses of everything. His liver had completely shut down. It wasn't responding to anything. Mm. The surgeon that was working on him looked absolutely defeated and just absolutely like he looked like he'd worked a long day. And he just had that chat with us and he said to me, you know, this isn't working. This has stopped working. This is shut down. And I stopped in midway and I just said, is my dad going to survive this? And he gave me 15% chance of surviving. That's if he didn't die going onto life support machine. Mm. That really hit me in the face. And I've never, ever in my entire life felt pain, physical and emotional. It's really hard to articulate, but I felt like I'd been hit by a bus. Mm. My whole body hurt. It hurt physically and it hurt emotionally. And it weren't just the hurt and the emotional pain of you're about to possibly lose somebody. It was the emotional pain of, I didn't get him to hospital 4 days ago. What have I done? I've killed my dad. I've done this. We didn't take this seriously enough, or we should have done more. There was so much guilt, so much guilt. And everybody says to me, or said to me, you know, it's normal to feel guilty. You always feel guilty when somebody dies. And I kept thinking, you don't understand. Like, I could have got him to hospital, but I didn't. I walked away. And dealing with that and trying to process that and forgive myself was really, really tough. It took a lot of therapy and a lot of counselling for me to accept that it wasn't my fault. I understand now, and I understand the reality of this illness and that it has a bigger ripple effect than what we even properly understand. But yeah, he went on to life support, and he didn't even respond to that. He held off long enough for us all to say goodbye, and then he slowly slipped away. And after his death, I was confronted with so many comments, and I think they were well-meaning, almost people trying to remove that guilt from me. But it was people saying, you know, your dad did this to himself, Sarah. He only had himself to blame, and it was self-inflicted, and he knew what he was doing when he was drinking. And it dawned on me, and I thought, but people who were saying this to me were heavy smokers or had type 2 diabetes because of their diet. And I kept thinking, I'm not saying that those illnesses don't deserve sympathy, but if you're applying that logic that drinking and alcohol addiction is self-inflicted, then surely that logic needs to be applied to all lifestyle choice related illnesses, right? Like, it's no dip, 90% of lung cancers are caused by smoking, a massive contributing factor to developing type 2 diabetes or coronary heart disease is our lifestyle choices, what we eat, what we drink, our lack of exercise. And then all of a sudden, all of these people are saying to me that it was your dad's fault he died. Nobody was looking at the bigger picture. And it was almost like nobody was giving him that sympathy that he deserved, because as far as they were concerned, it was self-inflicted, and it weren't spoken about. And it was that look of awkwardness on people's faces when you tell them. And it really broke my heart. It really, really got me so angry. Angry that myself, that I used to do that when he was alive, but it was almost like I suddenly realized when he died it was too late, and I wanted to do something, which is why I do what I do now. I wanted to make sure that my dad's not just another statistic.
Yeah,
I mean, he was shamed into remaining silent, and he was physically dependent on alcohol, which meant he needed alcohol like we need water to survive. And unless he felt that empowerment or that liberation to say, I need help, somebody help me, he had no choice but to carry on drinking.
Yeah, but I think also, you know, it's interesting, isn't it, that there just isn't enough awareness of just how bad this can get. Most people, you know, as you say, that the well-meaning relatives or friends who may have said, oh, he did this to himself, it's nothing to do with you, he did it himself, were probably at a funeral reception drinking.
Yeah.
Right? That's the reality of it. We go to somebody in my sober club this week said that she went to the funeral of someone who had died because of alcohol. And the invitation literally said, if you can't make the funeral, don't worry, please just come for drinks afterwards. It's like, does no one grasp the irony? People are just not aware of the dangers of alcohol, because everyone thinks, well, it can't possibly happen to me.
And that's exactly what we thought.
And yet, and yet, actually, it can. You can go down the slippery slope. Your dad wasn't born with this.
No, and he didn't choose to.
No, exactly. But look what happened to him. It's staggering, actually, isn't it, that there just is not more awareness. But there's a couple of things I just want to pick up on. It's a heartbreaking story, and it's amazing that you're doing this work. There's a few things I just want to pick up on. One is, you know, you said your mum sort of held it all together, you know, for you as a family. But looking back, and this is a really harsh question to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway. And the reason I'm going to ask it is because I know there will be women listening to this who are living your mum's life right now. So the question is, was she a part in this, in that she was enabling him? Much later down the line, you gave him the ultimatum, and at least it did kickstart 12 months of sobriety, from what I hear, at least, right? So was she actually enabling him? I'm not blaming her.
No.
Was it part of it?
Absolutely. Yeah, and we've had this conversation. But again, it's important to note that we didn't understand it as the illness it is.
Yeah, of course.
And I always say to people, actually, that I think the partners have it hardest.
Yeah.
Harder than the children, because at least I could escape. Mm. At least I could get to 18 and think, I don't want to live here anymore and move out.
Yeah.
My mum had three children and she was keeping everything together. So we had some level of normality.
Yeah.
At the same time, I'm saying to her, why can't you just leave him? Why are you doing this to us? But he didn't have anywhere else to go.
Yeah.
He didn't have family. He didn't have a job. Like, she was caught between a rock and a hard place.
I mean, any compassionate person, you can't walk away, can you?
No, and it's so difficult. And now I look back and I think, oh my goodness, what would I do in that situation?
Yeah.
Because you want to protect children from it.
Yeah.
But whatever decision she decided to take would have affected us anyway. And you know what? As horrible as this sounds, and my dad adored my mum, of course he did, but I don't think that would have been enough for my mum walking away.
No.
It needed to be all of us. And unless we were all at that age where we could all remove ourselves.
Yeah. And then, of course, if you've got the added issue, if you don't have the finances available to create another home, it goes on and on, doesn't it?
And it's a vicious cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is the work that Nakora do.
Nakora,
I beg your pardon. Yeah. Just tell me, remind me, I did an interview with Lisa and Alex who work with the charity, but just tell us a bit more about that charity.
So Nakora are the leading charity that support children. And when I say children, adult children, young children of parents addicted to alcohol. They do a lot of research into how it affects children in particular. And they also have a 24-hour helpline, which supports people, which is absolutely life-saving.
Yeah,
I didn't know about Nakora when my dad was alive, but there are so many children that come home from school, like I used to, that didn't know what environment or atmosphere waited
for
them.
So we're going to get,
And you just didn't know that. I didn't understand that. I used to think that we're the only ones going through this. Nobody else will understand. And it weren't until I started talking about how he died and campaigning like I do, hundreds, if not thousands, I've lost count of the amount of people that will message me and that will say, I used to feel like that. And we'll gel and we'll articulate something. And and you think, oh my goodness, I'm not the only one that does that.
Yeah,
I'm not the only, because there are so many traits, many traits that you develop, traits to protect yourself, traits that we used to do. Like, I used to water his alcohol down, pour it down the sink, mark it. I would be anxious all the time and preempting his mood or paranoid about what mood he was in. So many things. I second doubt myself now. Even now as an adult, there are so many lasting effects that his alcoholism has had on me.
And I'm guessing what happened for you then when you reached the age where your friends were drinking?
I never again, because it was so normalized and ingrained, I didn't actually recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
I would say actually that question is probably more appropriate now, because now I struggle with alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Did you drink? You drank as a teenager then?
Yeah, I drank as a teenager and I drank in my early 20s. And I was I would probably be what you classed as binge drinker. So I wouldn't drink regularly. So I'd only drink if we were going out. But when we went out, and if I was drinking, then I was going to make sure that I was drinking to get drunk.
Right. And that's interesting then. So that it didn't compute then. It almost didn't compute that this was the alcohol.
No.
Wow.
No.
Even though you were pouring his alcohol down the sink. Wow.
It was so ingrained. Now I do.
Yeah.
If I even have one glass of wine, I will be sick or I'll have some kind of, I hate it.
Good.
I cannot look at it the same. I can't enjoy it every time. I can't even buy it for anyone now and give it as a gift, because I look at it and think, well, that killed my dad.
Absolutely.
And that kills families, that kills people. And the other thing is, I'm absolutely petrified. I am my dad's daughter. I'm very much my dad. I share so many similarities and personality with him that it terrifies me that if I start drinking, what does that mean? Where will that end up for me? I'm petrified of it. And I think that's almost subconsciously now ingrained in me. I cannot look at it the same.
But that's a good thing, in my opinion. Yeah. It's a case of, you know, why would you want to? Why would you want to consider having one glass of, you know, I sometimes say to people, you know, let's and you've and what you've done on this podcast, on this interview, has really highlighted this, that alcohol is the number one most harmful drug.
Right? Absolutely.
We don't like that statement, because we like to think that it's just lovely and a bit of fun and all, you party pooper, but it's the number one most harmful drug when you take into account everything, all the stuff you've just been talking about, the, you know, the effect on families, the effect on the economy, the in everything. It is the number one most harmful drug. So if you actually just switch that word to heroin, even that last sentence you've said would just be like, everyone would just be, what? It's like, oh yeah, I can't even think about heroin now. Like, well, why would you?
Exactly.
You know? No, and that's what we need to do. We need to actually switch that word and stop this ridiculous rose-tinted spectacles thing that we have around booze, because the emperor is not wearing any clothes.
No, you know? And you know, the other thing is that absolutely baffles me is that cigarettes are so, they're hidden behind a screen. Mm. They've got graphic labels attached to them.
Yeah.
We all know that. We all know from multiple campaigns that smoking causes lung cancer, heart disease. Mm. Smoking kills people around, or passive smoking is dangerous. Mm. But yet nobody knows, or very few people, not nobody, very few people know that alcohol withdrawal is deadly.
Absolutely.
And when I say that to somebody, they look at me and go, what? Mm. And when I say to them, and I did a post on Instagram actually that, I weren't sure how it would go down, but I felt it was so important, because I kind of got the impression from a lot of people that when I said alcohol killed my dad, I think they thought, like, with smoking, it wasn't a direct effect, it was an indirect effect. So like, oh, what, did he have some kind of cancer that was caused by smoking?
Yeah.
No, alcohol killed him. On his death certificate, it says excessive alcohol use, a decompensated liver failure as a result of excessive drinking.
Yeah.
It directly killed him. Yeah. And it's one of a few substances where your body becomes physically dependent
Absolutely.
So you can't die from heroin withdrawal. Well, you might do, but not directly. Like alcohol, if you physically do not have alcohol, then and you're physically dependent on it, then it can kill you.
Yeah.
And it's the only drug that we celebrate.
Yeah, exactly.
We glamorize.
Exactly. We totally do. I want to pick up on something else, because, you know, we've been talking about the you know, the work you're trying to do, which is, you know, dissolve, remove these stigmas. When your dad finally got treatment, was there any stigma there?
Yes.
Really?
When he finally got treatment, yeah. Even when we sat in that clinic waiting for the doctor's appointment, he shed a tear, actually, and he looked at me and he said, I am so embarrassed.
But that was from within him. Was there any stigma? You know, was it, did he come up against any, the thing that he was most afraid of? Did he actually come up against it with the medical profession, for example?
So in A&E, when he relapsed, paramedics rolled their eyes at him. That was another telltale moment that gave me a glimpse into why he didn't want to ask for help. And there was articles, I remember him reading an article in a newspaper back in 2014, and it was a load of nurses saying how alcoholics are wasting NHS time and resources when they could be tending to stroke victims or heart attack patients, which is absolutely, it baffles belief really, because the majority of those heart attacks and strokes are caused by what we eat and drink.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're saying that, but alcohol withdrawal is deadly. And and I remember him reading that article, and I read it, and he didn't say anything. It was the silence, but it was the look, and it was the comments. It's the comments in the media. It's the comments from people in general. And it's not just that. And I'll tell you what speaks a thousand words: silence. Silence from family members, distant family members, friends that don't check up on you. If you'd have told them that, and I'm sorry to relate everything to a cancer, but it feels like smoking is one of the biggest causes, isn't it, of cancers. But if he would have had lung cancer from smoking, he would have got get well, or I'm thinking of you, or I'm really sorry to hear that you're going through this.
Yeah.
But it's almost like oh, that's alcohol addiction. Don't talk about it. It's a dirty secret.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I get that completely.
That's a harsh comparison.
No, I understand. And you're right. That has to change. It has to change. Of course, you know, as you said before, with anyone that's, you know, drinking too much, with anyone that has these traits, you're shining a light on other people's behavior as well. And that's probably one of the reasons they don't want to look at it.
But you're right there.
What a story. What a story. So tell us about, I mean, how could this have been different? What do you want for someone else who is, you know, back up a bit from where you're, you know, from what happened to you? What could happen to change this scenario for someone else?
I always feel like the foundation to this change is to destigmatize alcohol use disorder, because if we destigmatize it, then people, and I'm not saying this will work for every dependent drinker, some people don't want the help and you can't force that, but for a lot of people, and a lot of people I've spoken to, they all say the biggest contributing factor to them suffering in silence is the stigma.
Right.
They don't want to ask for help because they don't want the backlash. So I think ultimately, if we can work towards destigmatizing this, then we will encourage more people and empower more people to recover out loud and not recover in silence.
How do we remove the stigma? Give me a couple of ways that it could change.
I feel education, awareness.
So the more of us that are aware of it, are able to have that compassion. You know, we talk about being kind, don't we? Why don't we extend that out?
Well, I always think if we could put as much energy and effort into campaigning around the dangers of alcohol like we do cigarettes, then a lot of people will understand.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, I mentioned this because it's going on right now. I have a colleague who has a charity, and she is one of the things the charity is doing is given some funding to create a focus group in a specific area for be careful how I say this, don't want to reveal everything, but anyway, the long shot of it is the focus group is to gather information for the NHS on a particular group in an area on their approach to services for mental health and for mental health, for counseling, for menopause for women, and for smoking. Right now, because she's linked to me, she said and alcohol, and they said, oh no, that's not one of the problems. Really?
My God!
So you're looking at a diverse group of people who are not making use of services, not getting the help that they may need, and these are the areas that have been identified that they need to look at in their focus group: menopause, mental health, you know, smoking. I mean, all good stuff, but what are they thinking? They were actually asked, and do you want to cover alcohol? No, that's not an issue we need to look at.
It's massive. So there's a statistic, isn't there? There's 2.6 million dependent, not grey area drinkers, not binge drinkers, dependent. It's a different type of alcohol addiction. Well, 2.6 million dependent drinkers in the UK.
And there may be more if they're like your dad and they don't let anyone
exactly. know. And I always say that that is what we know of.
Yeah.
They're the 2.6 million people we know of. And that's not to mention their families.
Yeah.
And the partners of those, the children of those. Even my husband was affected. It's a domino effect.
Yeah,
it affects everyone.
Yeah.
I can't believe that. That's
So raising awareness.
Yes.
And you know, the more people that know about this and can have some compassion, that's going to help. Is there anything else sort of very specifically that can be done?
I think something needs to happen in Parliament around
let's not even, I mean, you know, why are we laughing? Let's not even get started at the example they're setting.
Oh my God. No, you're right.
As we record this, they're all receiving fines. Well, that should sort it then. That should sort it all, shouldn't
it's
all good, as long as we cough up the 50 quid, all good.
Yeah, there's an amazing book actually from Professor David Nutt, and I quoted him in my TED talk.
Alcohol, Drink. Drink.
And it really encapsulates everything in terminology that you can understand, and it makes you quite angry.
He says
in there that the reason he was fired was because he weren't conforming to the narrative. He was saying that alcohol is the most dangerous drug.
That's right, and they didn't like that.
And I think that actually that's one thing that needs to change, and if anything can change, it's almost like it's a massive problem that's been brushed under the carpet and it's not been acknowledged. It's totally the elephant in the room. If that can change in Parliament and that can be addressed, like cigarettes and smoking is addressed.
Absolutely.
Then we would, more awareness would come naturally.
Yeah,
more campaigns, definitely. More education, definitely. More people recovering out loud. And I think that's so important. And there's so many influencers, and I call them influencers because they are rightly so. They're inspirational people on Instagram, people like yourself that are recovering out loud. They're talking about what they're going through, and that is so remarkably helpful for these people. It gives people that encouragement to know that you can do it, and it opens you up to a community, and I think that's so important. I've never been part of a more empowering or embracing community as the sober community. And I've not been affected by alcohol directly. I've been indirectly affected, and the embrace and the welcoming and the support that you get from the sober community is just absolutely amazing, I think. Really do.
Yeah, fantastic. So give us the, can you give us the website for NACOA?
I believe.
I can put it in the show notes.
I think it's nacoa.org.uk. Let me have a look.
Cool.
Where are we?
I can find it and pop it in the notes anyway.
It's nacoa.org.uk.
Okay. And that's N-O-K-O-A.
Yes. And I'm also doing a lot of work myself with my own organisation, which is warriorkind.co.uk. And we're doing some campaigns at the moment around how drinking affects the loved ones, and how, we've got a big campaign coming out around... Just Have a Drink is what I've called it. It's one of the famous sayings, isn't it? Oh, just have a drink. And it all starts with that and the damage that eventually escalates to, really. That one sentence.
Yeah. Well, Sarah, thank you so much. Thank you for being so honest, and thank you for the work that you do. You know, it's really special. I'm sure this will help a lot of people. So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Those links will be in the show notes. And I really, really look forward to seeing, you know, what comes out of the various campaigns that Sarah is running. If you're listening to this and it's really kind of brought up stuff for you, then please reach out. You can always message me. There is so much help available. Alcohol Change UK is a great charity that can offer, you know, lots of free advice and support and help. Just get support whichever which way. It may not be right for you to connect with the stuff I'm doing, but there'll be somebody else out there that you want to connect with. Just don't suffer in silence. That's the most important thing. You know that I offer family constellations events, and they can be so powerful in going some way to healing some of these wounds. So the next one is likely to be 22nd or the 29th of May. I'm not exactly sure, but please drop me a message if that's something you're interested in, and see if we can get you signed up for a family constellations workshop, because honestly, it's life-changing. It's literally life-changing being able to look at some of this stuff. So do message me if that's of interest. Check out the other events that we have coming up. We're just in a little bit of a transition period, so we're trying to get some things on the site, but they'll be there as soon as possible. If you're listening to this on Friday, as soon as it's released, then don't forget there is a meetup in Edinburgh Saturday 23rd.
with a couple of our Sober Club accredited coaches. So go to thesoberclub.com, click on events, and it won't be too late if you want to grab yourself a ticket. And I'm hosting my Sober Club coaches training this weekend. I'm super excited about that. It's just brilliant seeing how people, you know, just get excited about starting to branch out into whole new areas of work or add new tools to their toolkit. And, you know, this for sure is an area that, you know, the more of us doing this work, the better it can possibly be. It's been great, actually, to see. There's been so much more in the press. I was featured in an article, I think I mentioned, in the South China Morning Post. I had quite a lot of interesting messages as a result of that. And then there was that great piece in The Times. I think it was in The Times by India Knight, a really well-established journalist, has written a piece on about calling time on Wine O'Clock. So, you know, it's in the zeitgeist, guys. You know, we're ahead of the curve. We are absolutely the lucky ones, to quote that fabulous book title. We really are. And to quote another fabulous book title, we are happy, healthy, sober, right? Or at least we're heading that way. I'll see you same time next week. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.